Good morning. While I'm waiting for the slide to load, my name is Deji Adefuye. I'm the director of the HIV Research and Policy Institute at Chicago State University, where I also hold a faculty appointment in the Department of Health Studies. What I'm presenting to you today is actually just a subset of a large study that was conducted with students in a minority serving institution in the Midwest. Most of the studies that previously have been done in terms of looking at HIV risk behaviors among college students have been done largely in colleges where most of the students actually reside in the dorms, and most of them actually have been done in colleges that were in the rural parts of the country. So we thought this actually was the first step in the design of an HIV prevention intervention for students in this particular university. I don't have any financial relationships to disclose, so estimates actually have shown that at least half of all HIV infections in the U.S. Currently occur among those who are below the age of 25 years. And, you know, I'm sure that we have a lot of people here who either are in colleges as professionals or as students. And, you know, when you're just transiting from being a teenager to going into those years when you have your newfound freedom, you actually test the, you know, the waters of a lot of many risky behaviors. And a CDC study actually in 2002 actually said colleges are actually the epicenter of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And that's something that is that's actually important. While you might not go out there and be able to find a lot of data directly in terms of the HIV prevalence among college students, the study that was done by Dr. Gale in 1990 actually estimated that 1 in 500 college students are actually infected with the HIV virus. And we do know, we've heard it all day, that actually African Americans actually have a higher burden of HIV infection when you look at the U.S. population. So at the same time, African American college students also have, they actually share the same burden. And I'm not going to go through most of the statistics. You've heard enough of statistics today. And what we set out to do, because this was, like I said, it was a large survey. We looked at a whole bunch of different risk behaviors in which students actually engage. And this portion actually deals with not just risky behaviors that students actually engage in. We look at their knowledge. We looked at the myths that, you know, some of them still harbor in terms of HIV and AIDS. We looked at what kind of behavior they engage in, and then we also looked at their perception of risk. Because it's one thing for you to actually, you know, we've seen all these risk behaviors, particularly the data presented by Dr. Thomas and Craig Spivey. But the thing is, do these men, despite all these things that they know, do they actually perceive themselves as being at risk for HIV infection? We know that most of HIV infections actually occur among college students, actually occur through sexual intercourse, be it heterosexual sex or homosexual sex. And we also do know that students engage in a lot of other risky behaviors, drug use, combining alcohol and drugs prior to having sex. And we know basically what all these things do. So our design was cross-sectional. It was a one-shot thing. And basically, we were able to recruit 390 student volunteers from various academic disciplines within this minority-serving institution, which predominantly actually is, I think, as we go along, you will see that most of these students are actually commuter students. They are not students who stayed on campus, which made this population much, much different from most of the other populations, student population that have been studied in terms of looking at HIV risk behavior, HIV knowledge. We did get IRB approval before we did this. And in going into this, we wanted to be clear in terms of what exactly do we consider HIV risk behavior. And we had to define this up front so we know exactly what we're looking for when we go into analysis. And these were the things that we considered. We considered early sexual debut, which was initiating sex before the age of 15. multiple partnerships, inconsistent or non-use of condoms, and also sexual intercourse under the influence of alcohol or other psychoactive drugs. We looked at the university curriculum for the whole year, and we were able to identify 174 general education courses. The reason why we use general ed courses is just because these are courses all students have to take. We didn't want the question of discipline to actually bias whatever it is that we're going to find out at the end of the day. We got permission from instructors to do this. Of all the instructors, of all the, I think, were 34, 38 that we approached, only 18 actually gave us permission to go to their classes. So we actually went to the classes, provided information to the students beforehand, and then we went there on the day of data collection. We had a research assistant who read the script and got everybody's consent before we asked them to complete the survey. We also gave the students $10 book vouchers for the time that they spent in doing this. Our survey instruments, we did not want to reinvent the wheel because we know there's a whole lot out there, so we actually adapted instruments, and the instruments listed here were the instruments that we adapted. After adaptation of this instrument, we did pre-testing, post-testing, and we also actually computed the psychometric properties of the instrument just to be sure that we were using something that was, you know, that was validated. So that was what that was exactly what we did. That's not for discussion today. That actually is a different thing. So these are the different sections of the survey instrument, and these were the things that we looked at. I'm not going to go into them line by line. So we had to define certain things. I already told you how we described or define sexual risk behavior. In terms of looking at consistency of condom use, this was the question that we asked during the past 30 days. How often did you or your partner use a condom? And in some cases, for those who are sexually active, who had not had sex within the previous 30 days, we decided to use, the last time you had sex, did you or your partner use a condom as a measure of condom use in that context. And risky sex behavior was scored as one, and then those who did not, I was actually scored as zero. In terms of the measure of knowledge, we actually used a composite of six questions that actually has been used by the World Health Organization in terms of indicators of reproductive health, and we actually scored knowledge from 0 to 1. If you got 1 correctly, you got 1. If you got all the 6 correctly, you got 6. In terms of perception of HIV risk, it was just a question of what are the chances that you might catch HIV? And those who said the options there were, would you say there is no chance, moderate chance, or a good chance? Those who said it had a good chance were scored 1, and those who had other options were scored as 0. So, in terms of analysis, we did all the simple just to look at the demographic variables and other things, and then we went ahead to actually look at multiple regression. And in our multiple regression, basically, we were looking at condom use during last sexual intercourse, frequency of condom use in the last 30 days, and the number of sexual partners, which were the things that we set out for this part of the study to do, and we assumed a significance level of alpha of 0.5 for all testing. So I'm not going to waste a whole lot of time on this, but one thing I want you to know here is that you will see that the preponderance of our students, 83.1%, have never been married. And when you actually look at the percentage that are actually married, it's just about 6.7. This becomes important as we go along. The mean age, we're dealing with a group of students who are non-traditional students, so to say, mainly commuter, urban, minority serving, and you can see the age range all the way from 17 to 64, and the mean was 23.8. So in terms of knowledge, you can see we decided to separate male and female here, and you can see the mean, you can see the knowledge scores and standard deviation for male and female. Not a whole lot of difference, but you also, when you look at the risky, in terms of risky behavior, we already defined risky behavior, you will see that more females actually engage in risky behaviors than males. These are the different sexual risk behaviors that we looked at, and then you will see those male and female, you will see what proportion actually engage in those risky behaviors. Here we were looking at are factors that are associated with multiple partnerships within the previous 3 months. And you can see here, those who were over the age of 30, and this are everyone together, male, female, were less likely than those below the age of 20 and those within, within 20 to 29 to actually have multiple partners within the last 3 months. I'm not going to spend the rest of, spend more time on this. That was the only significant finding in that. When you look at multiple partnerships within the previous 3 months and you look at male and female partnerships, there were no areas of significant differences. And you will see that, when you look there at marital status, males who had female partnerships, you will see that even though it's not significant, you can see, you will see under the odds ratio, they are almost 2 times more likely than others to have multiple partners. And this is male and male partnerships. And you will see here that those who use marijuana and also those who use other forms of illegal drugs were much more likely among those male-to-male partnerships to actually have multiple partners within the last 3 months. This is actually important as we go along, because you will see that a lot of some of those who actually exhibit one particular risk behavior tends to also exhibit some of those other multiple some of those other risk behaviors. This is actually looking at those who had not used a condom during the last sexual intercourse. And you will see here, those between the ages of 20 to 29 were, those 30 years and above were much more likely not to have used condoms. You can see 3 times more likely, even the unadjusted odds ratio. And then you also will see that females were much more likely not to report condom use at last sexual intercourse. And this is really a big issue. We all know that females are much more likely to get infected with the virus than males. And we look at all these issues, it boils down to the issue of self-efficacy and some of the things that's been already been discussed here today. And when you look at marital status, you will see that those who were separated or divorced also, when you compare them with those who have never been married, also actually are much more likely to have not used a condom. And when you look at the question of drinks, those who also have had drinks within the last, at least within the last 30 days, were also more likely not to have used condom during last sexual intercourse. One thing here that I actually just want to point out, if you're looking at what's associated with inconsistent condom use, you will see females again almost 2 times more likely than males not to have used a condom during last time sexual intercourse. So in terms of looking at risk now, look at for males, those who consider themselves to be at risk, you will see that 91.5% had low risk perception. They just thought that even though they were doing all those things, they didn't consider themselves to be at risk at all. Also, when you look at the female, it's almost the same. And when you look at the whole group together, you will see that about 92%, almost 93% of those who engage in risky behaviors perceive themselves as not being at any form of risk for being infected with the HIV virus. It's really very interesting. There are lots of things that came out of this, because while we're doing this, we're actually looking at our students. Are they exactly the same like students in other colleges? All the things that have been found have been done predominantly white student populations, those who live predominantly in the dorms, and those who probably most of the time are in rural colleges. Do they actually exhibit the same kind of risky behaviors? We found that it's exactly not the same. And one of the things that we're actually thinking about here is that it's not enough for you to just go there and just do a blanket intervention, so to say. People need to be able to, on each individual college, be able to do this assessment, look at what the student populations actually exhibit before you go ahead. Even within our own student population, the student population that we worked with, if you look at those who were divorced, male and female, the females were less likely to have multiple partners. Divorced males were more likely to have multiple partners, but when it comes to the issue of condom use, the females who were divorced were less likely to use condoms at last sexual intercourse. And, you know, whatever protection that could have been there, that could have been conferred by not having multiple partners, is actually eroded by the fact that they're not using condoms. So that actually is something that is extremely important. All these differences needs to be examined. And in conclusion, it's there. They engage in all kind of risky behaviors. It's actually extremely important that, you know, we recognize the differences and take these differences into consideration as people go along to design their interventions. Limitations, it was one college, one institution. Some participants left questions unanswered and everything. But we still think, though, that this is actually something that contributes a lot to the literature, and this is actually something that people might want to think about as they do their own planning. We have to acknowledge that the Illinois Department of Public Health and the state of Illinois actually provided funds for us to conduct this study. We are happy that they were able to do this, and also want to acknowledge those students, other researchers. The research director of the Institute, Dr. Abiono, is here. She did most of the crunching of the numbers, and also want to let you know that this is actually an opinion of the research team alone. It's not been endorsed by the Illinois Department of Public Health or the state of Illinois. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And to those presenters that actually did do their verbal and slide disclaimer, we appreciate that. And the rest of you will actually have to take back in the interrogation room and find out if you had any. So we're now open for discussion and for questions. We have a large group. We have plenty of time. And I'd also like to say that any panelists that have a question for your fellow panelists, feel free, or comments. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Right. Well, so this gentleman had a comment saying that we had a slide up that indicated that the men who we sampled did not have a strong influence, or their influence was not from the popular media, a popular culture. And what we found was in some of the men's comments were, some of the issues that impacted their ability to protect themselves were, you know, issues that, you know, sort of involved in their lives in general. So the issue of having a job, the issue of being being employed, all of these issues that, again, that we talked about with the social determinants of health slide, where their risk were influenced by their ability to even focus on that. So that wasn't even an issue for them by virtue of the other issues that they had going on. So, you know, other health issues, you know, that chronic medical problems. So they didn't see HIV prevention, limiting sexual partners as a big deal for them at that moment. So does that answer your question? Both of those slides were examples that they did not feel like that the popular culture had a strong influence on their views on HIV or their view or their ability to have safe sex. And it's, so both of those were like this illustrating the same point, but just one was on sex, one was on HIV. There may have been a quote that was, but I'm not sure what you're referring to. Yeah.
By the media.
Yeah. Yeah. So and again, the other issue becomes, you know, you wonder if they had a perception, or did they tell me what they thought I wanted to hear? You know, so, and again, at one of the events that where we sampled the guys were at was at a local church. They have a brotherhood conference, and we were again in Chicago. To infiltrate the church network is difficult, especially when you're asking about sex and HIV. It's not an easy thing to do. But again, when we were able to come in, they were. You wonder how many of them felt like, well, is Pastor gonna see this? And what does the doctor want me to say? You know, does he want me to? So that's a piece that we have to take into consideration as well.
Are they could just be, I'll shut up. Mm-hmm. Are they could just be unaware to the extent?
Sure. Sure, and that's another good thought.
It's probably great too when you do these type of qualitative type studies to look for common themes,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes it speaks to how many people you've actually had a chance to actually interview.
Sure.
Yes.
I want to comment on the slide that you had up. I think you said it was a Harvard sociologist.
Yes.
I actually have concerns about that.
Mm-hmm.
When you're saying, like, we don't, you know, talk to people and there's so much, you know, statistical regression, really kind of gives research a bad name.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many of us that look like me that are actually doing this research.
Mm-hmm.
And what really brings the dollars that allow you to be able to focus on African American is by actually doing the research. As an example, you gave the guy who said that he thought that being diagnosed with HIV was a death sentence. When you look at larger studies of African American men, all these, you know, kind of poster boards that are up, the bumpness that the people see, they're coming from the drug company, knowing what Magic Johnson is out there, you know, making boo-hoo bucks, you know, and what have you, actually have led a larger number of people to be concerned that, you know, indeed, if I get HIV, I just take a pill. As a matter of fact, I look better than I did, you know, before. Because after they see the ads from the drug company, it's like, they think the drugs make you look buff. That was the ad. So I guess I want to really try and advocate for the notion that people really realize that there are a number of African-American researchers. We do talk to folks. We do very quality work, and would, you know, say that you might want to look at some of that work. John Jamont, for example, has an adolescent program, and that adolescent program has been through much statistical regression, et cetera, and it turns out to work. So when you're looking for, like, well, what can I do for adolescent African-Americans, he's African-American, he did it on African-Americans, and it's working in some other places.
Sure. Well, I appreciate that comment, and I think it's, you know, good to hear other researchers who care about the population and are making meaningful, you know, progress.
I'm trying to hop back and forth from one side of the room to the other. Someone had their hand up over here.
Is that a question for Dr. Martin? About your career study. I was curious for the men who were heterosexual versus those who are bisexual, difference you saw in terms of social support.
Mm-hmm.
Did you measure heterosexuality by self-definition, or was it by behavior?
No, it's by their self-definition. Mm-hmm. All of the men in our study reported having sex with a man. So this was how they, but we asked them, how do you identify yourself? Do you consider yourself straight? Do you consider yourself gay? Do you consider yourself bisexual?
So
mm-hmm.
active with a female 5 years ago, but you still consider yourself to be bisexual versus
right.
You know, there was a transition and now you're consider yourself bisexual, but really you're
dissident. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we're starting to look at that, and that's really important. The point you're making is that sometimes your behavior doesn't really match your identity, or there may be some discongruencies there, and that's really important, and that's why we asked both kinds of questions. We asked, how did you identify yourself, and then we asked about their behaviors. So we do know, for example, 40% of the black men in our study reported having sex with a female. A lot of them considered themselves bisexual, but some of them didn't. Some of them called themselves gay, but then they also had female partners. So there are a lot of interesting sort of things to look at as those two intersect.
But for this analysis, you
Correct. For this analysis, it was only their self-identity.
You know, one of the things that we after we had different when we in terms of partnerships, we had those who had male to male partnerships, we had those who had female and male to female partnerships. We also actually had those who were female respondents that we asked if they had male partnerships and if they had female partnerships. In terms of, and you will see that in my presentation in the slides that I showed, I did not look at unprotected sex in female to female partnerships, and that was deliberate. It wasn't like, you know, that we didn't look at it. We just decided we're not going to report it because we really see that there's very minimal risk in that kind of relationship. That's why we just reported on male to female, male to male, female to female. We're not concerned about whether it was vaginal sex or anal sex, but the bottom line is we're actually looking at sex. And considering the fact that we already have those relationships defined, what we're looking at, the risk behavior there is actually not using condoms. It wasn't the question of what kind of sex it was.
The reason why I'm asking is because deceptive anal sex is a lot more risky than deceptive vaginal sex.
Absolutely. We absolutely recognize that.
In heterosexual relationships,
yes.
Heterosexuals have anal sex, and women will actually, not just in other countries, but in the United States, say that they're still virgins, because they just have receptive anal sex. So I think it's very important to delineate that, because there's a much higher risk for heterosexual women. And since you said they weren't using condoms,
yes.
I was kind of curious whether that could be teased out in the analysis, because that's very important to know.
Okay, you know, even though we did not ask that question, and in our survey, I completely agree with you. Receptive anal sex is probably the most risky, and you know, we actually had cases in Chicago in which we actually had a number of female clients who, quote unquote, were still virgins. But what actually happened is they presented in the emergency room with gonococcal proctitis, which was actually gonococcal infection of the rectum, and it was a question of why are we seeing all these cases of gonococcal proctitis, only to find out that these were actually girls who were engaging in anal sex just because of the cultural thing that they needed to preserve their virginity. This was not one of the things that we look at, and I completely agree with you, but the whole notion of looking at risky behavior was actually the question of not using condoms. We understand and appreciate the fact that even when you consider unprotected sex, you know, along the whole continuum of, you know, where you're doing it and all those things, that there are some that are more risky than others. Thank you.
So, actually, my question was for you also. Okay. So, there were actually two things I was thinking about when you were doing your presentation. One of which was, I'm based out of the District of Columbia, and they've just done their new surveillance report for HIV, which have the worst rate in the country,
mm-hmm.
also on the 15 to 25 age range. So two things. One was thinking about the age range and thinking of the messaging that these students have received and looking at the type of messaging that has been approved by administration, regardless of how you look at administration over the past 8 years. Do you think that had an effect on some of these behaviors, the anal sex, the vaginal sex, things like that, in terms of where are we learning about sex, where are we learning about how you can't contract HIV, and do you think, or was there any questioning in the survey that you guys did about where did they get their educational knowledge because they go through the number of risk assessments? That was the first thing.
Okay.
And the second thing was, you made a comment that the females are the boss when it comes to condoms, and that really didn't sit well with me. For lots of different reasons.
No, I didn't say they were the boss. Okay.
Primarily about heterosexual interactions between young men and young women.
Yes.
And being able to self-advocate for safer sex practices and knowing that there is a female condom, but I don't know of anybody who uses them. And really thinking about how is a young woman supposed to negotiate demanding that her partner uses a condom. And I didn't know if you were able to speak to those two issues.
You know, parts of our first, I will address the first question. We did ask them the sources of information, where they get information about HIV prevention from, and all those things. That actually is not part of this. You know, it's actually a much bigger study. We did ask them where they got, you know, and if my memory probably maybe, you know, will serve me well, I think that most of them actually got substantial amounts of information from peers than they got from parents, that they got from school. Okay, that's the first one. The second question was about the fact that in terms of condom use, the bottom line is that we actually have, you know, a study that we're actually planning to do now in terms of actually looking at the sexuality and sexual risk behavior of African-American men in Chicago. The bottom line is we have found out in terms of some of the things that Dr. Thomas talked about, the so-called cultural norms, in terms of even what Craig talked about, that they're not using condoms just because they don't want their friends to find out they're not using condoms. The bottom line is that we have all these issues in terms of, you know, the so-called, quote-unquote, eating it raw, how you are less of a man if you're using condoms and all those things. If men are doing those things, it behoves the woman to be able to protect herself. That's where the issue of self-efficacy comes in. And that actually is part, based on what we found out, that actually is part of what we're trying to do in the intervention that we're planning to do with our students. Because we know that the females were much more likely to report not using condoms. And we thought that, okay, females are much more likely to get infected than men, and, you know, depending on, you know, whether it would, even for vaginal sex. And the bottom line is that if your partner he might possibly put you at risk, why don't you now take the bull by the horn and accept the responsibility of protecting yourself and not just leave yourself, you know, to the whims and caprices of your male partner? It is the issue of self. That's where self-efficacy comes in.
This can get very provocative, so I just want to point out that we have a panel of people who will answer questions up here, okay? But I'm going to give you a chance to follow up, but this lady had her hand up back here, so I want to get her question first. Can we have a moment of silence, please? Now, where in that dissertation was your question? I'm sorry. I got you. No. First, I want to ask Jennifer to speak, because she was talking about social networks, but I'm really interested in that differentiation between sexual networks and social networks that you just posed.
But it's related somewhat. In our study, we found that most of the black men in our study, for example, had only black partners. And so this is getting at some of that relationship, and that is one of the hypotheses, as you know, that one reason for these high rates are that because of these closed networks, and also because men may tend to get diagnosed later and not get maybe have less access to healthcare and less access to testing, there is more infection in that network, you know, before the person can get help or can get care. So I think that is true, especially for the MSM population.
And you also asked about college campuses.
Yeah,
let me just say this. For the first couple of slides that I showed, there is actually what you said is absolutely correct. The 2006 study published by Al Tao and colleagues actually showed, I think it was a study that was done in North Carolina, actually showed that, you know, there was an increase, actually was a trend of increases in new HIV infections among a network of students who were in some colleges on the South. Networks do have some influence, and when you're actually looking at networks, it's really just a question of what are they engaging in. It's really, you know, one of the things that we did was to try to actually piece out some information, you know, in terms of those who are in sororities and fraternities among the student population that we did, but we really didn't find any significant differences. That's really why I didn't talk about them. But the thing is that within those networks, you know, within those fraternities and sororities, there are certain behaviors that are more or less entrenched behaviors, so to say, that kind of tends to engender some of these risky behaviors, but we did not find any of those things, and that's why we didn't report them. But I completely agree with you, networks actually do play some role. And the fact that, you know, this is a student population that actually is a committed population. So our students are not completely insulated from what actually happens in the different communities from which they come from. So we also are quite aware of that fact.
We have like five. I'm sorry.
Well, you had the variable multiple sexual partners. Is that looking at over 3 months? Is that looking at concurrent relationships or more serial matches?
We decided not to tease that out. But because the thing is, some of, you know, there is no way you'll be able to capture every single information, everything you want, with a quantitative study. And that's actually why this study that we're doing actually has a qualitative aspect of it, which is not reported here, that actually goes deep into some of the things that are being raised there, also actually including the issue of, you know, receptive sex, whether it's anal and all these other things. You need to know that when you actually have, we add a survey that had 139 questions. And when you have a survey that's a whole booklet, you actually really discourage people from wanting to take it. So we actually had to tread the line between making sure people do it and the amount of information that we're able to collect.
All right, thank you. We have just a few more minutes, so we'll try to hurry up and get about 3 more questions in, if possible. Yes, sir.
Okay, my question is for the Dr. Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Dr.
Yes.
You know, as I was listening to you, and you spoke about media,
mm-hmm.
and you spoke of two things, media, and you also spoke about this unknown hospital on the north side.
Sure. Oh, no.
One of the things I'm from Chicago, Richard,
sure.
and I work with quite a few people, and one of the things I found from talking with my youth is that they are very influenced by the media.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I like that you said is that the youth would prefer, like the rappers and whatever else, to have some more positive lean toward HIV
mm-hmm.
and X and sex.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Sure.
My question for you, specifically regarding that, is do you believe, have you, and I know time is very limited in terms
mm-hmm.
of your part, but mm-hmm. is it networking with organizations, community-based organizations mm-hmm. and universities, Fruit and Hospital, to sensitize that Northside Hospital about taking care of our people? When I mean our people, I mean poor people, neglected people, like that.
Yeah, I think there is a you know, a movement that, you know, we can debate on how sincere it is, of institutions to become more community friendly. In particular, the University of Chicago, underneath the leadership of Eric Whitaker, just started a urban health institute. Now, you know, you can debate that, you know, it's just, you know, it's all, you know, dog and pony show or whatever. But I think that if we can bring to the hospitals a community-based participatory research program that, while the hospital may have a vested interest in trying to have a media perception that we're community friendly, you can do some good work or whatever organization you're a part of to serve that community. But I think you got to find a win-win for the institution plus the people that you serve. And so I think that there is, especially when you can use as a bargaining tool, because one of the things that when I talk to Dr. Whitaker, that he does is he says, well, you know, Northwestern has this thing going on, and they put $10 million behind this, you know, and we can't be second to Northwestern, can we? And so when he talks to the dean like that, and he's like, oh, really? So, okay, yeah, well, you know, we'll put $15 million behind that. And, you know, so I think we have to sort of I want to say political partners that can help put the muscle behind the institutions to say, listen, you have to take care of the communities that you are surrounded by. And I think that there's a increasing movement to have that to happen.
I'm going to take one more question from somebody that didn't get a chance to ask one.
Thank you. I was very interested in what happened with the students. The parents of the school, did they get any of your feedback, the data from the kids, and what did they think of that?
This, what we did here, I just reported on part of it. We also interviewed adult men and asked them some of the similar questions. We retrospectively asked them what were their thoughts about HIV and sex when they were between 10 and 15 and what they think of it now. And what we're finding is that it's a developmental issue, that as men age, they begin to become more mature in their beliefs about sex. And because most of them also have children, now they're seeing it as, I don't want to just protect me, I want to protect my 13-year-old boy or my 9-year-old boy who will still be coming into his sexual career. So, and what we also found is that I thought the interview would last an hour with the men. It lasted an hour with the boys, but the men talked about 3 hours. They wanted to tell us, because we said, what information you give us will help us develop programs for these young boys. It's not going to help you, it's going to help the young boys. And they were committed to helping these young men, young boys, even though they were not their children, they didn't know who they were. So that, in fact, they took cigarette breaks and came back. So that was refreshing to know that men want to make a difference.
All right, I think this was an excellent group, an excellent panel, and excellent questions. Let's give them a round of applause. And thank you all.
Yeah, actually at 32 years.
So you could make
got 75% of the salary.
Yeah.
Okay, I only have 20 years. But maybe in about 3 to 5 years I can.
Okay, well, good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah.